We know that in time past, whenever a crisis arose, Hampton always supplied its quota or contingent of volunteers to serve in the armed forces. So when war broke out in Europe in the summer of 1914, there were people in Hampton who were deeply concerned and felt that something should be done towards meeting this new situation. With that in mind, they began to form or get together a National Guard unit that might serve with the state forces in time of disorder and in time of national need and crisis, might serve under the federal government. With this in mind, they began to enlist and organize a battery of field artillery to take its place in the Virginia National Guard. In the fall of 1915, I enrolled as a student at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg in preparation for a career in the ministry of the Episcopal Church. Early in November, I got word that a battery of field artillery was being organized in Hampton, and that if I wished to join, I should be there on the 6th of November. And so I went home over the weekend, and on November 6, 1915, I enlisted as a private in Battery D, 1st Virginia Field Artillery. Period. At that time, our armory was the old power plant on the south side of Sunset Creek, which had been abandoned when the power company it served went bankrupt, and we used the car bonds as an armory. And I remember gathering there that evening of November 6 and enlisting. At that time, National Guard units were permitted to elect their own officers. And so an election was held, and Captain Frank Couch was elected as our captain. Lieutenant Thornton Jones was our senior first lieutenant. Lieutenant Bob Sugden was our junior first lieutenant. Lieutenant Charlie Powell was our senior second lieutenant. And Lieutenant Floyd Taylor was elected to be our junior second lieutenant. Bob Sugden and Charlie Powell and Floyd Taylor were all graduates of EPI. Indeed, the Battery was a bit dominated by the VPI tradition for a long while. Our first Sergeant Warren Howard was an old VPI boy. The sergeant of the first section, Cecil Wood, went to VPI. The sergeant of the second section, to which I was assigned as a private, was a VPI graduate. And my corporal, Philip Ranson, was a VPI man. Our gun corporal was Bonnie. The sergeant of the third section, Roland Koch, was a graduate of the University of Virginia and of its law school. J.L.B. Buck, who had served on the faculty at the Normal School, was a sergeant, as was Edgar Outen, a VMI boy, and Howard Bonneville was our quartermaster sergeant, and Doc Mara became our stable sergeant. I returned to college and continued my studies there. I came home for Christmas, of course, and went back. And followed my studies until commencement time in the spring. When I returned to Hampton in early June, I was able to get my old job back on the Dollar Lawson and made one trip up the James River and came back, and then the paper announced that the president had called up many units of the National Guard, and I reported at the Armory for duty on the 19th of June, 1916. We were not a very soldierly or smart-looking unit at the time. We had never been issued uniforms, and it was every man for himself, and so we appeared for muster in a variety of clothing. Some had a service shirt or hat, some a pair of breeches or shoes and so forth, but I can't recall that anyone was completely dressed in a formal standard uniform. But in a few days, we entrained for Richmond. And we went up to Richmond. And there, on the 5th of July, 1916, we were mustered into federal service at Camp Henry Carter Stewart, along with other units of the regiment. For there we found Battery A from Richmond, Battery B from Norfolk, Battery C from Portsmouth, and our Battery D, of course, from Hampton, Battery E from Danville, and Battery F from Lexington and Rockbridge County. Camp Stewart was in the Ginter Park section of Richmond. We were put in tents, 8 men to a tent, and we had no permanent structures or buildings, and spent our time in foot drill and instruction. We were issued our uniforms and equipment, of course, and began to look more like real soldiers. And then late in the summer, we took the train for Texas. Mr. Villa, the Mexican bandit, had been raiding border towns in Texas, and the paper said the president called us up along with all the other National Guard to chase Mr. Villa back to Mexico. We didn't catch Mr. Villa, but we did have a great time in Texas that winter. We went from Richmond to San Antonio, and in San Antonio, when we detrained, we went to Camp Wilson. Camp Wilson was just on the edge of Fort Sam Houston. And there we were issued horses and had our guns and caissons and equipment and drilled. And in a few weeks, we marched by easy stages. It took us 2 days to march from Camp Wilson out to Leon Springs, out in the sand hills, possibly 20 miles out of San Antonio. And there we were to spend the winter in training and drills and maneuvers and gunnery practice in the hills. It was a tremendous experience for all of us. I was assigned as the lead driver on the second piece. That simply means that I rode the near or left-hand horse. Each gun and each caisson was drawn by a team of 6 horses, pulling in pairs, the lead, the swing, and the wheel teams. And each team had a driver. Not 2 drivers, but 1 driver who rode the left hand or near horse. And it was my duty to ride the near horse in the lead team that drew the gun in the second section. And immediately behind us followed our caisson with the ammunition and the gunners with its team of 6 horses. My brother George was assigned as driver, the lead driver on the caisson in that same second section. Sergeant Phillips was our sergeant, and Sergeant Ranson was our caisson corporal. We slept in tents, 8 men to a tent. And we were roused at reveille when we stood in formation in the Battery Street and answered to the roll call. And then after breakfast, we went down to the picket line, and we had fed our horses before we fed ourselves. But we went back to the picket line and groomed the horses and watered them and harnessed and hitched them to the gun and caisson carriages, and went on a march through the hills in long lines. Found an open space where we could have formations and learn to maneuver, and so spent the morning in drills. In the afternoon, as a rule, we had instruction in the in the duties of a soldier, and particularly, of course, of an artilleryman, and how to take care of the horses, and how to take care of the guns and caissons and equipment, and how to do everything that a soldier must know how to do. Happily, and as I look back, I'm sure it was happily, we had as officers men from our own town, men who knew our parents, men who knew who we were, and who would be understanding and sympathetic and helpful as they were. Time after time, I recall there were incidents when we were very happy and grateful that our officers were men we knew and who knew us and who knew our families. I'm so grateful that we had this experience. At that time, a private received $15 a month as pay, and so we were not too flush with money, but we had enough to get into town occasionally and go to a movie and buy a dinner at a restaurant just to break the monotony. But we stayed there through the winter, and then we turned in some of our equipment and put the rest of it on flat cars and in back box cars, and we came back home to Hampton in we came back in early March and were mustered out of federal service in Hampton on March the 11th, 1917. It wasn't but a few days, really, before the United States entered into the First World War, and we answered the call of April 2nd, 1917, on April the 3rd, 1917, and were transferred from the Virginia National Guard to the 111th Field Artillery, United States Army, the 29th Division, on September 15th, 1917. But in April we were sent to Newport News and went in camp along the riverbank of the James River just above the shipyard, and we were on duty guarding the shipyard. We had a gun, I think two guns, on the piers in the shipyard in case a German submarine might have sneaked in and surfaced there to do damage, which it never did, of course. But we were on guard at the shipyard all that summer and in camp there. On May the 11th, 1917, while we were on duty at the shipyard, I was made a corporal. Now, a corporal is the lowest possible rank in the Army, and yet I think one of the most important grades a man can hold. Because until you're a corporal, you're just one unknown among many. But after you've been made a corporal, you realize that your captain knows you're there. He knows who you are. When he sees you, he has confidence enough in you to make you a corporal and give you responsibility for duties above those that are borne by a private. And so I rejoiced when I was made a corporal and was proud of my rank. And then we were sent to Camp McClellan, Alabama. We went over to Norfolk on the ferry and took the train and went down to Camp McClellan, Alabama. We were among the first troops to arrive, right out in the woods. Not a street, not a convenience of any sort. And we set up camp there among the trees and cut down trees to make a battery street. And we were issued horses, and we laid out the camp so that the tents of the men were up on high ground, and then it sloped down to a little creek. And below that creek were the picket lines for the horses and the gun park. And there we were to spend the winter of 1917-18. The coldest winter I had ever experienced up until that time. At one time, the thermometer registered 2 below 0, and I wondered how people could live at such extremely low temperatures. But we did. About all we did was to look after the horses and cut enough wood in the woods to keep our little stoves going in our tents to keep warm. We didn't do much drilling. We simply survived. But we did survive. And then in early February, well, wait a minute, I'm ahead of myself here. Soon after we got down there, on the 24th of August, I was made a sergeant. I was made what we call the reconnaissance sergeant. The reconnaissance sergeant has charge of the 5th section. And they're the boys who have the responsibility of communication with field telephones and signal flags and flashlights at night, and to make maps for the battery and find gun positions for the guns when you come up on the line, and to be the eyes and ears of the battery. And I found that work very, very interesting, indeed fascinating. But in September, on September the 15th, 1917, I had orders to report to the regimental office, to the officer in charge there. At that time, we had a fine young Captain Satterfield from Richmond, an old VMI boy, who was serving as the assistant adjutant. Captain Jeffries was our adjutant, but Captain Satterfield was the assistant. And he was a Cap Alpha from VMI. And I had orders to report to Captain Satterfield. And I went up there and went in and saluted and reported to him, and kept my hat on, of course, and campaign hat. And he said, "Sergeant, give me your hat." And I took off my hat and gave it to him, and he took the red hat cord of the field artillery off, and he reached up on the wall. His hat hung on the wall, and that had on an officer's hat cord with the black and gold cord. And he took that off and put it on my hat, in place of the red one he'd taken off, and he put it on my head and he said, "Now you're second lieutenant in this man's army." And this was the way he conveyed to me the information he had just received from the War Department to the effect that I'd been commissioned a second lieutenant of field artillery in the United States Army. Some weeks before that, I had orders one day to report to one of the offices at the divisional headquarters. And when I arrived there, I found 12 or 15 other sergeants from the field artillery and the cavalry and the engineers and the infantry and every branch of the service, and three officers, a major and two captains, as I recall, were there to greet us and to speak to us. And they told us that we were being considered as candidates for commissions as second lieutenants. And we weren't going to have to take a written examination. We weren't going to have to take any kind of an examination. But they did want simply to talk to us and quiz us a bit and get some estimate of these men who were candidates for commissions. And so they did. It reminded me of the story that went the rounds about that time of the Navy. It seems the Navy was desperate for junior officers. All of a sudden, overnight, they had to increase the fleet numerically, many, many more ships, which meant tens of thousands more men. And this meant many, many more young junior officers, and they simply didn't have them. And so they scoured the colleges and universities for likely-looking material. And an officer went to one of the colleges, and he got a group of young men together who said they were interested, and he quizzed them. He said, "I don't expect you really to know anything about the Navy, but I just want to look at you and ask you a few questions. I'm going to ask this gentleman over here to tell me who he thinks may have been the three greatest naval officers ever to serve in our Navy." And the young man thought a moment. He said, "I would guess John Paul Jones and Stephen Decatur, and I didn't get your name, sir." And he got his commission. Well, that's about the way I got my commission. We weren't even examined. But the commission came through, and instead of being the sergeant of the 5th section, I was now the lieutenant, the reconnaissance officer in charge of the 5th section in the battery. And then early in February, I was ordered to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to take the course being given there in the School of Fire for field artillery. That simply means that the Army had established there this school that taught you the fundamentals, the rudiments of firing the guns of field artillery, of estimating the range and direction and all that sort of thing, and having the practical experience of firing guns to see whether or not you were ready to go overseas. And so I took the train from McClellan and went out to the post at Fort Sill, the School of Fire. It comprised about 1,200 officers from all over the Army, of every grade, from colonel down to my grade of second lieutenant. As far as I could find, I was the only second lieutenant among the 1,200 or so officers attending the school. They took a class every week and graduated a class every week. And the school ran, your class ran for 10 weeks, 2 months and a half. And my colonel was there. He had been sent out there. He was getting on, and he wasn't up to the minute, and he didn't pass his grades, and so, poor fella, he was sent home. But you can imagine my state of mind to discover that among all these 1,200 officers, colonels, majors, lieutenant colonels, captains, and so forth, I was the only second lieutenant there. But I began my studies, and I found that they were very practical studies, and for the most part, the things I had been doing for some weeks or months back in the battery. And so I knuckled down. The first task they gave us was to make a map of the reservation at Fort Sill. And there's a story to that I'll tell you presently. And we went to classes all morning, and in the afternoon we went out on the range and witnessed the firing of the guns. And when our turn came, we had to direct the fire several times, three or four times, there in the presence of our instructor and the members of our class. It was a rugged course, and I've always referred to it as a chamber of horrors. I think because I was a bit overcome by the fact that all these men around me were my superiors, and I had but little chance of making the grade. One day, one of my instructors, a lieutenant colonel, a handsome man, a quiet, gracious gentleman he was, stopped me as I went out of class, said he wanted to see me a moment. He took me in his office, and we had turned in our maps we had made. And he took out of the desk drawer of his desk the map I had made and asked me if this was indeed my map, and I told him it was. And he asked me a few questions as to how I'd gone about making it, where I'd started, and how I went about measuring distance. We measured distance by pacing. We didn't use a chain or a rod, but we had to pace. But I'd done this before, and it was an old story. And then when he got through questioning me as to how I had made the map, he took out another map and walked over to the window, and he put my map up against the window pane and superimposed the other map on it. And to my surprise, the two maps were identical. And he said to me, "What does this mean to you?" I said, "It has to mean, sir, that either I traced the other man's map or he traced mine." "Exactly," he said. And he took my map back. Well, he took both maps back and put them in his drawer, told me I was excused, and I went back to my barracks, a deeply troubled young man. I knew I hadn't done anything wrong, but I knew that a few bunks or beds from me in the barracks, we had long barracks with maybe 30 or 40 men in a row on either side. Each man had his desk with a drawer. That one evening, just as I went out to a class, a handsome young captain from the Illinois National Guard He asked me if I had finished my map, and I told him I had. He said, "You mind if I see it?" I said, "No, of course not. It's in that desk drawer." And so I went on out, and when I came back, the map was in the drawer where I had left it and where he had returned it. And so the next day I looked around and I couldn't find that captain, and I never saw him again. And then I knew, poor fella, that he'd been shipped home for having used my map in that way. That same instructor stopped me again one day after class. I wondered what on earth was up now. And he said, "Lieutenant, why aren't you wearing your insignia of rank?" And I said, "I don't understand, sir." He said, "Don't you know there's an order out from the War Department that second lieutenants now wear a gold bar?" When I went to the school, second lieutenants didn't wear any bars at all. And many of the old army people called us mister. But a new order had come down from the War Department that second lieutenants were to wear a gold bar. He said, the instructor said, "When on your way back to your barracks, you better go by the commissary and buy a pair of bars." I said, "Thank you, sir." And so I did, and I felt very proud and flashy to have those gold bars. Well, every week we had a test and examinations for what we had studied and learned that week. And every week I went up every Saturday, fear and trembling lest I would flunk and fail and be shipped home. But the 10 weeks passed, and finally on the end of the 10th week, we received our certificates. It's the only certificate of graduation I've ever received from any institution of learning, and so I'm very proud of it. And I have it today. It's dated May the 3rd, 1918. And I have it among my treasures to this day. And so I took the train back to Camp McClellan, Alabama, going through Memphis and so on home. When I got back, I was assigned briefly to Battery E from Danville, and then for just a few weeks to Battery F under Captain Letcher, a remarkable soldier, man old enough to be my father. And he was sent home, poor fellow, before we went overseas. The army felt, no, Captain Letcher was not sent home. He went overseas with us and commanded the battery all the while we were in France, and came back with us when the regiment returned in the summer of 1919. I don't know why I had in mind that he had been relieved of his command and sent home. There was much talk of it from time to time, but it never came to pass, happily. And in Philadelphia, we took the ship to go overseas. Of course, at McClellan, we'd turned in our horses and guns and caissons and tents and all of our equipment, everything except the uniforms we wore and the few personal belongings we carried with us. In Philadelphia, we boarded the City of Exeter, an aging British ship that had been built for use, I think, in the trade to India. But we filled up the holes and the decks and every possible space, and we sailed from Philadelphia and went up the coast to Halifax. And there in the harbor at Halifax, we found a flotilla of ships that formed a convoy of 16 ships that went overseas together as a fleet. And so we sailed from Halifax. And no sooner had we gotten out into the Atlantic, it was a calm morning, the boys were all on deck, when a ship crossed our bows, another freighter carrying a red flag at the head of the mast, indicating that he had ammunition or explosives on board. And we just barely missed running into that ship by, it seemed to me, inches or feet at least. But as he passed our bow, his stern came up and our bow came up, and we pulled apart, and when we went down in the next valley between the waves, we'd pulled away from each other just far enough so there was no danger. But it was a close call. It had been foggy, and that other ship had suddenly appeared from nowhere. And our captain, a British seaman, of course, was out on the end of his bridge, and with a megaphone, I can see and hear him now, calling to that other captain on the other ship, "Where are you going with that boat?" And to us, we were on the bow. There were perhaps 100 men or more up on the bow, just curious to see what was happening. He called to us, "Lay aft, lay aft." Well, very few of our boys knew what he was talking about. He meant to come aft, come back to the stern, come off the bow. He was afraid that if we ran together, those men on the bow would be knocked into the sea and lost. But anyway, we went on. And just off the coast of Ireland, there were 16 ships in our convoy, spread out like a fan across the ocean. And as we approached the Irish coast, an British cruiser came to escort us into Liverpool, which it did. And we went into Liverpool and tied up at the docks. By that time, when by the time we tied up, it was dark, it was night, and the lights on the docks were on, and an officer, British officer, came down on the dock, smart-looking officer with his Sam Brown belt, which was all new to us, and in his English voice and speech, he read to us a letter from His Majesty the King, welcoming us to England, and wanted us to feel at home, and how grateful they were for the service we were to render alongside the British in France. Well, one of the boys in our outfit wasn't too smart, and he thought it was the King himself who had come down to welcome us, and he remarked that he thought it was pretty decent of the King to come down that time of night in the rain and stand there to welcome us. We assured him it wasn't the King. I don't know that he ever believed us. He didn't want to believe us. But then we were moved by train from Liverpool down to Southampton, and there we boarded the ferry that took us across the channel to Le Havre. And at Le Havre, we were put on the train and went to the French Field Artillery Training School and camp on the south coast of France. Now many of the officers were detached from our units temporarily and sent to Camp de Meuccan in southern France to the field artillery school, which might be compared to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. For that, Camp de Meuccan, we had to not forget everything we'd learned at Fort Sill, but to transfer and transform all that knowledge from yards into meters. In the States, we had been issued the 3-inch field piece that was then in use in the American Army. But when we got to France, we had to learn to use the French 75, which is comparable to the American 3-inch. But the 75 is a superb gun. I think it's recognized by artillerymen around the world as maybe being the finest gun of its caliber that was ever made. But I must back up just a moment to say simply that while I was at the School of Fire at Fort Sill, I received word that my commission as a first lieutenant had come through to the regimental headquarters in Camp McClellan, Alabama. And so I went overseas as a first lieutenant. And after our training at Camp de Meuccan, we rejoined the regiment, those officers, those among us who had been taking that course. And then we began to move slowly up towards the front.